19th-Century Protestantism. The 24th talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought was presented by David Crabtree on May 2, 1988, for McKinsey Study Center's School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
The stuff that I'm going to talk about tonight, I know very little about. I got most of my information from Colin Brown's survey, Philosophy and the Christian Faith, and then there are a couple of chapters in Justo Gonzalez's book, his set, going through that set. But other than that, most of it is philosophy, the stuff that I haven't looked at. But there are, just as an overview and kind of giving the justification for why include this lecture at all. After the Reformation, there were forces that were unleashed by the Reformation that moved in a couple of major directions within Christianity. After the Reformation, theology became stale, and it's called Protestant scholasticism, that period of time after the Reformation. And out of that, within Christendom, there developed two movements. One was Pietism, and we've talked about that. And that was an attempt to try to reinvigorate Christianity by injecting the spiritual aspect of Christianity back into it. They believed that had been lost. The other development is towards rationalism. Now, with the Reformation, there was an accompanying movement, usually called the Enlightenment, which affected arts, literature, and everything else in Europe. And as the Enlightenment worked itself out, it became more and more divorced from Christianity. And there develops what is usually considered true rationalism, that is, God was removed about man's thinking about the world. That had an effect within the Christian community, and theologians began to explain away the miracles, explain away inspiration, the literal inspiration of Scripture. They tried to, as much as possible, remove the supernatural from Christianity. And there are a number of philosophers who were also theologians who played a part in that. And primarily in Germany, we see a line of philosopher theologians developing that more and more divorces Christianity from the supernatural. And then that eventually makes its way to the United States, and that trend continues today. If you want to know what is going to happen theologically in the Protestant seminaries and centers of academia in America in 10 years, look at what's happening in Germany now. And eventually it comes over. And that's been happening since before the turn of the century. So that pattern is set up very early, and it continues to this time. I think it would be a fascinating study to determine how misunderstandings of great thinkers have had an effect on society. For instance, Einstein's theory of relativity was extrapolated from the realm of physics into the realm of morality. Einstein said, it doesn't apply. That's, you can't make that jump. But that jump was made by popular thinkers, and it has affected, I think, it has affected our society to this day. And there are other similar examples. Hegel's the best example. People go in almost completely opposite directions and say that they are following Hegel's ideas. And I haven't read Hegel, but Jack says he's the hardest, he's probably the hardest philosopher to understand. So it's easy to see how they would misunderstand and go in different directions. But I think it would be interesting to follow that up and see to what degree misunderstandings of philosophers have affected society as opposed to correct understandings. Jack and I were talking about it. His guess is that it's about 50-50, that 50% of the time they are correct understandings of the philosophers that work themselves out in society, and about 50% of the time it's incorrect understandings of the philosophers that work themselves out in society. Gonzalez traces this stuff all back to Galileo. Basically what Gonzalez is trying to do is chart how men have thought about the world around us in light of Christianity. Try to put the two together. Some of these don't try to put the two together, and others are definitely trying to, but the key issue is how do you put those two together. Galileo is the one who, according to Gonzalez, got things going. He said that experience is our only source of knowledge, that we cannot trust any other source of knowledge. So it's a matter of going out and observing, and on the basis of observation, determining how the world works. And it was his belief that you could describe the workings of the world in mathematical formulas. So the only true description of reality is that set of mathematical formulas. Something that has always baffled me about the Greek philosophers, and again, I don't know much about it, but as they carried their philosophy further and further, several of the schools end up in mathematics. That it's through mathematics that you reach an understanding of the ideals. Pythagoras went in that direction, and the Neoplatonists went in that direction. It would be interesting, I think, to follow up to see if there's any similarities between what Galileo and some of the scientists that come after him are trying to do, and what the early Greek philosophers are trying to do. In Greek philosophy, it seems bizarre. But in our day and age, the idea of describing reality in formulas, mathematical formulas, that sounds very appropriate. The next person is Bacon. Bacon, his concept was that an understanding of science, if we correctly understand the world around us through science, we can better rule, have dominion over that world. So it is necessary for us to explore the world around us and understand it correctly. And he stressed that we need to use a rigorous method in order to correctly understand the world around us. He agreed that experience is our only source of knowledge, but it's not just random experience, it's experience that is carefully controlled. And so he is usually credited with the development of the scientific method. Well, the experience that you're observing, well, it's both, it's controlled and it's screened and selected. What he describes is a scientific method where you put together the components of a given experience, and then you do the same thing, only removing or changing one of those components. But he believed that if we could do that, observe and control the situation and observe again, we can put together a model of reality and understand it correctly. He claimed that there are four obstacles to knowledge. He calls them idols. idol of the tribe, which is common to all of man, has the tendency to generalize too quickly. The second one is the idol of the cave, and that is each individual's personal temperaments and the obstacles that those face. The next, the third, are the idols of the marketplace. Those are the obstacles that are presented by human language, its imperfections, and imprecision. And fourth is the idols of the theater. And those are beliefs that are passed, inherited from past generations. And it's that fourth category that he was most concerned about and spoke against most forcefully. The last one is the idols of the theater, and those are the inherited beliefs from past generations. These are obstacles to gaining true knowledge. If you have read Marsden's book, Fundamentalism in American Culture, I think it's the name of it, he traces fundamentalism back, the ideas behind fundamentalism, back to Bacon. What he claims, well, I'll talk about this later, but he was here just recently. What he claims is that fundamentalists started when conservative Christians applied Baconian principles to the Bible. So, and that, obviously, from Marsden's perspective, is a bad thing. The next person in our lineup is Descartes. Now, each one of these is stripping away a little bit more. Descartes, his approach was to say that nothing can be assumed. We need to go right down to ground zero and only base our knowledge on that which is indubitably true, that which just has to be true. So he describes his process of thinking. He went away and was sat in a room and just started thinking, trying to go from ground zero. And in his book, Meditations, but he just sat down in a room and he started thinking, how do I know, for instance, this chair exists? It could be a dream, pursues that idea, and decides that he can't know that chair exists. And then he says, well, how do I know that I exist? So he keeps going down to try to find the zero line. How do I know I exist? And he concludes that he knows he exists because he thinks. He thinks, then he must exist. I think, therefore I am. So that becomes ground zero. That must be true, that he is convinced that he exists. And the way that he knows is because he thinks. And then he proceeds from there to prove that God exists. He proves that God exists because he has a notion of God. And that notion of God had to have come from somewhere. And if a person has a notion, there has to be some source for that notion. Even mythical beasts have a source for their notion. For instance, a centaur is a composite of a horse and a man. Well, that is the basis for that notion, is putting two known things together. But God is not a composition of known things. God is something other. Therefore, God must exist. So he proves God exists. Then the question is, does this chair exist? He comes back to, does this chair exist? Well, if I exist, and if I have a notion of God, and therefore God exists, then this chair must exist because God would not deceive me. Well, he spells it out in a lot more detail in this book. But that's, very briefly, that's the route that he takes. He has established, he thinks, without any assumptions at all. He's gone down to bare ground zero, and he's established that he exists, that God exists, and that the external world exists. So that's the beginning of trying to build up a knowledge of reality via those kinds of steps. And Descartes then is followed by quite a number of thinkers to one degree or another. There is one difficulty that develops in Descartes that continues to be a source of controversy for about a century. And that is, Descartes, in his first step, only proved that there is something, there is an I, which thinks and therefore it exists. And then later he gets to proving that his body exists, but he is not certain that the two are the same. I mean, he seems to think the two are not the same. But there is a body in which he is present. So this body-soul distinction, how do they relate, becomes a problem that's talked about by later philosophers. The next fellow, I had never heard of before, therefore I even know less about him, a French philosopher, Malebranche, I think it means bad limb. He's a French philosopher who combined Cartesian thinking, Descartes' thinking, with some Augustinian ideas in a manner which did injustice to Augustinian's ideas, according to Gonzalez. What he combined was Descartes' kind of stripping things down to nothing with some mystical ideas of Augustine. Well, according to Gonzalez, they weren't real Augustinian thoughts. They were perversions of Augustine's, what Augustine actually taught. What Malebranche said is that God is all ideas are known in God, and God is the guarantee and object of all knowledge. And that's basically the Augustinian component. He gets that from Augustine's theory of illumination. And I don't know what that is. But God is the only thing that can be known. God is, all ideas are basically in God. God is the essentially the cause of everything that happens, the cause of all things. So then he is able with that to put together the problem of the body and the soul. There's an illustration that Gonzalez uses, and I assume that it comes from Malebranche, and that is of two billiard balls. If you hit a billiard ball against another billiard ball, that second billiard ball is propelled from the collision. It is moved, knocked away because of the collision. Well, according to Malebranche, that first billiard ball did not cause that second billiard ball to move. God caused that second billiard ball to move. It just so happens that God caused it to move at exactly the same time as the first billiard ball hit it. So there's no necessary link, it's just that God did it at that time. And because God is an orderly God, he does it every time the first billiard ball hits the second billiard ball. But both actions are controlled by God and caused by God. And using that analogy, he solves the problem of the soul and the body. The soul thinks, right arm, go up, and the right arm goes up. But there is no cause and effect relationship there. It's just that God put the idea, right arm, go up, into the soul at the same time as he made the body raise the right arm. Well, he says that to do that would be to impart divinity to the first billiard ball. If the first billiard ball can cause something, then you are saying that it participates in divinity. Only God can cause. Hobbes. Now, the most important thing I know about Hobbes is he's on the first-year reading list of Mortimer Adler's 10-year reading plan. Leviathan's on it. Hobbes, it'll be interesting to read the book. He tried to figure out how a kind of comprehensive understanding of the universe on the basis of a few principles. It was his belief that things can only be perceived if there is a change in motion. If there is no change in motion, then they can't be perceived. And that the laws of motion are inertia, causation, and conservation of matter. On the basis of those assumptions, he tried to build a whole system, which includes ethics, political science, a view of the natural world, and everything. All of knowledge was based on the idea that only those things which have a change in motion can be perceived, and you have to base your knowledge on that. God is removed from his system because there is no change in motion in God. So God is not a part of that system of knowledge. That all seems very strange to me. I don't understand what he means by a change in motion. He's completely outside our ability to perceive and therefore have knowledge of it. So he's completely outside of the system, which sounds familiar. And he is the beginning of the English empiricists. No one can have knowledge of you. Spinoza is the next one. Now we start getting into the Germans, where he's Jewish. He built upon the Cartesian system. He concluded that true knowledge only comes through mathematics, and he tried to use mathematical type thinking with respect to ethics. He proved ethical theorems in the same way that you would make geometric proofs. It was his belief that all reality is one substance, and that there are just different attributes to that one substance. And he applied that to the body and soul problem. All of reality is one substance, so the body and soul are just different attributes of the same substance. So there's no problem with communication between the two. They're both part of the same one. And that one, that one reality is God. And man's job on earth is to bring himself in line with that fact, that all of reality is one substance. Next one is Leibniz. Leibniz, 1646 to 1716, he reacted against Spinoza, and his claim was that everything does not happen out of necessity. From Spinoza's perspective, everything happens out of necessity. It's a matter of just getting yourself in line with what is happening, adjusting to it. Leibniz said, no, that's not true. He says we have to make an important distinction. There are truths of reason and there are truths of fact. The truth of reason is like the three angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. That is always true, it has to be true, because it's part of a logical construct. But there are truths of fact which just describe the actual order of things, the way things are. It is raining outside. But that doesn't have to be true. It could not be raining outside. It could have been that way. It just isn't. So, with the truths of reason, it's true. They are true by necessity. But everything else is true because God willed it to be so. And this world is like it is because God willed it to be so. And God willed it to be the best of all possible worlds. There are two kinds of truths. And he says, he agrees that when it comes to truths of reason, those are true by necessity. But what he's claiming is Spinoza, apparently, is that Spinoza didn't realize that there's another category of truths, and those are truths of fact, for instance, that it's raining outside. But there's no reason, there's no necessary reason why it has to be raining outside. It's just that God chose to have it rain outside. So the truths of fact could be different. God just wills them to be the way they are. So it's not the same fatalistic type of perspective on the world as Spinoza has. In fact, Leibniz is a very utopian perspective because he makes the further assumption God willed this to be the best of all possible worlds. He claims that all ideas are innate and that the mind learns nothing from experience. I don't know where he gets that. That's wonderful. Locke. Now we skip to England for a little while and look at the English empiricists. Locke is followed. He's another Englishman. So we have a line of Hobbes, Locke, and the next one is Hume. And they are. Locke claims that there are no innate ideas, quite the opposite of Leibniz. That all knowledge comes from experience. However, divine revelation is a kind of experience. So he claimed that Christianity is true, but we know that it's true from experience. But what has to happen in Christianity is it has to be subjected to rigorous reasoning and stripped of all of the things that have crept in over the centuries and returned to a simple Christianity. But that simple Christianity is true and valid, and that we can know that from reason, on the basis of experience alone. It is at this time that the deists develop in England, and that spreads to the United States, and deism was very influential in the formative years of the United States. Many of the founding fathers were deists. And the deist perspective is that there is a God who created this whole mess, but once having set it in motion, he now stands back and allows it to run its course and is inactive in the everyday affairs. Hume is the next fellow, and according to Gonzalez, he's the one who takes English empiricism to its extreme and what he calls takes it into a cul-de-sac. He says if everything we know comes through experience, then we can't know that there is cause and effect. Cause and effect can't be determined via experience. So, for instance, going back to the billiard ball example, if billiard ball 1 hits billiard ball 2, all we can know is that billiard ball 1 was going right along and came to the place where billiard ball 2 was, and then billiard ball 2 starts rolling along. That's all we know. We cannot establish cause and effect. That can't be determined via experience. Therefore, we can't know substance. We can only know smell, color, feel, etc. We can only know what we perceive, strictly what we perceive. We don't even know our own thoughts. All we know is what kinds of perceptions we have, what kinds of experiences we have going on in our head. And since we can't know any of this stuff, then according to Gonzalez, deism was no longer viable. And it's not real clear to me why that just does away with deism. Seems like it does away with a lot more. But that was the end of the strict empiricism movement. That if what Hume was saying is true, then basically we can't know anything. That became a dead instrument or a cul-de-sac. All we know is that things are happening in our head, right? Now back to Germany, Kant. All data comes from experience, but we can't experience the thing itself. Now he's saying something that's similar to what Hume said. However, what Kant says is that there are two aspects. There is the phenomenon, that is what we perceive, and there is the noumen, that is what is the substance itself, the thing behind the phenomenon. So he divides reality into the phenomenon and the noumen. And he claims that we have built into us innate organizing principles, such as time, space, unity, plurality, totality, etc. I think he had 12 of them. And these are universal and unalterable. Everyone has them, and they will not change. So the mind is able to take sensory perception and, using these unitary principles, put together, organizing principles, able to put together a model of reality. Now, the problem is our mind can only accept that data which is compatible with those organizing principles. God is not compatible with those organizing principles. Therefore, we cannot perceive God. God doesn't fit into our world view, our perspective, because we can't gain experience of him. Well, he's generally the one that is pointed to as the one who divided the world into those, what's called the upper and lower story. At least, I don't know where that term came from, but that's the term that I've heard used. The world is split into the spiritual realm and the material world. And that we cannot gain access to the spiritual world. All we can gain access to is the material world. So it divides all of knowledge into those two neat compartments. And then his thought is taken further conveniently to basically either remove the spiritual part or to say that it doesn't matter. Well, I'm pretty sure that's where Schaefer traces that to. I think that's his analysis that I have heard through other forms. And a number of things are attributed to that bifurcation of reality, including the change in the view of the inspiration of Scripture is attributed to that. I don't know what all else, but he is often pointed to as the bad guy. And by all accounts, he's been very influential. He was a very religious person, however, and there's this other half to him that is hard to plug in. Religion is important because it helps us to live a moral life, and religion should be encouraged for that reason. But true religion is based on revelation. It's not based on revelation, but it's natural religion. That is, religion based on what we see and experience. We have no knowledge of the existence of God, etc., because we have no experience of him. But the tenets of religion ought to be maintained because they help us to lead a moral life. And that's the goal of religion. That's what's important. We can't live without morality. It's ultimately essential. Hegel is 1770 to 1831, and he's the one that Jack says is almost impossible to understand. He claims that reality isn't logical, but rather reality is logic itself. It is constantly unfolding. I don't know what that means. I don't even know what the descriptions of what he says mean. History is merely the unfolding of the spirit. And that had implications for Christianity. The history of Christianity becomes the unfolding of the purposes of God. That particular point is significant in that it spawned a great deal of research into the history of Christianity in Germany soon after his time. And a lot of our knowledge of the history of the Christian church is influenced by those early historians who started the research. Well, they had presuppositions that were very naturalistic, rationalistic. So, for instance, that's where we begin getting the newer ideas of how the Bible came to be, as opposed to Paul sitting down and writing what God told him, have the church, or at least the very beginnings of those kinds of ideas come out, start then from those people. Hegel was extremely influential in the lives of other thinkers. For instance, Darwin was heavily influenced by Hegel, and Marx, obviously, with the dialectic. Apparently, the dialectic came from Hegel. According to Gonzalez, Hegel didn't mean the dialectic the way Marx used it, but too late now. Fearmacher, 1834. He says that religion has no claims on anything in morality or science, because religion only deals with man's piety. Here's a quote from him. It deals with the consciousness of being absolutely dependent, or, which is the same thing, of being in relation with God. Religion has no claims on anything in morality or science. Religion deals only with man's piety. And here's what he means by that: the consciousness of being absolutely dependent, or, which is the same thing, of being in relation with God. So it's only in that realm of man's consciousness of being being dependent is the only role, only place where religion has a role. It is not based on intellectual reflection, it is a feeling, this piety. And doctrine is important because it preserves the purity of the original experience. That's the only reason that doctrine plays a role. We know how the early church got this feeling of piety, and we know what doctrines they used to get this feeling of piety. So doctrine is important to us because if we reproduce that doctrine, we should be able to reproduce that feeling. And that feeling's all we're after. I think what he's trying to do is, and he's just following in the same line as the other thinkers, and that is, how do we deal with the supernatural? How do we, everyone else in this climate in which they were in, is perceiving things very materialistically. The only thing that exists is what you see and feel and smell. And that's that which you don't perceive. What do you do with that? Basically, what do you do with the spiritual? Well, in order to be an intellectual and that sort of thing, you have to, for the most part, be a materialist. So how do you account for the spiritual? And that's what they're trying to do, is account for the spiritual. And he has reached a place where he is saying, all the spiritual is a feeling. We've reduced it to a feeling. And doctrine is that which is necessary to reproduce that feeling, and that's all it is. That's all that's left of religion. That's all that's necessary. So I think that's more the route he came. Last person, Kierkegaard, from 1813 to 1855. He was the beginning of the Christian existentialists. And he was reacting against kind of dead orthodoxy that existed in, was it Denmark? Is that what he's called?
Mm-hmm.
Denmark at the time. And the thing that he was troubled by is, it doesn't matter what you believe, if it doesn't make any difference, then what does it matter what you believe? So he put a lot of emphasis on it mattering. What you believe, that what you believe makes a big difference. Here's a quote from here that's kind of interesting and probably the most helpful description of what of the essence of what he's saying. And so I say to myself, I choose. That historical fact means so much to me that I decide to stake my whole life upon that if. Then he lives entirely full of the idea, risking his life for it. And his life is the proof that he believes. He did not have a few proofs, and so believed, and then began to live. No, the very reverse. That is called risking, and without risk, faith is an impossibility. To be related to spirit means to undergo a test. To believe, to wish to believe, is to change one's life into a trial. Daily test is the trial of faith. So he emphasized the need to just believe and take that risk, as opposed to giving cold arguments for a particular belief. Brown makes this observation, which is interesting. For Kierkegaard, the paradox of faith means that belief must be proportioned in inverse proportion to the evidence. The less evidence, the better. Faith and reason are mutually exclusive opposites. With Kierkegaard, what counts is not what you know, but how you react. And that's definitely a concept that is unique to this day with him. That faith is in proportion to the unbelievability of something. The greater, the less believable it is, the more faith is necessary. And that is good. That's an idea that persists. And then,
Dave, who are these guys? Are these professors in universities, or are they bishops, or what are just authors? Or
most of them are. Most of them are professors. With most of them have had a significant amount of theological training. And they became professors as philosophy developed.
Were they professors of theology, or were they professors of philosophy with theological background?
I think it's some of both. I don't know. I'm pretty sure Spinoza was a professor, but I don't know what he taught. Leibniz, I'm pretty sure he was a professor, but I don't know what he taught. Was a professor, but I don't believe so. Hegel was a professor, but I don't believe so. I think they taught theology, so I'm not positive. I think Kierkegaard was independently wealthy. I don't know what he did. I don't know that he worked at all.